Welcome to Pzena Perspectives, brought to you by Pzena Investment Management, a global value manager known for our commitment to fundamental research and disciplined value investing. Today's episode is the recorded audio from our recent 2023 Outlook for Value webinar, featuring our new CEO, Caroline Kai, and President, Allison Fish.
Good afternoon, good morning, everyone. Welcome to Pzena's webinar, 2023, The Outlook for Value. My name is Adrian Jackson. I'm based in London, looking after clients. I'm delighted to be joined today by my two New York-based colleagues who are on your screen, Allison Fish and Caroline Kai. Before we get started, as I always do, I want to start with a bit of housekeeping, please. We plan to do this webinar with some pre-prepared questions that we've worked on that we think will give you some insights into what the markets hold for us this year, bearing in mind where we've come from and where we are at the moment. We're planning for that to take about 25 minutes or so, which will give us plenty of time for questions. We're going to have your questions at the end, but by all means, feel free to answer them throughout the webinar using the button at the bottom of the screen. If we don't get to your question, or you don't feel that we've properly covered it in full, please do feel free to follow up with us afterwards. Also on that matter, the webinar is being recorded. If you'd like a link to the recording, please get in touch with your regular Pzena contact or just drop an email to info@pzena.com. As I think everyone knows, we are a global deep value manager known for our commitment and dedication to disciplined value investing throughout the investment cycle. We're also well known for how we implement that discipline through a fundamental and systematic approach. And probably most importantly, or just as importantly, how we kind of do that with a team-based approach. So before getting started, I just want to briefly introduce Allison and Caroline, who have been with us for 22 and 19 years respectively. They have over that time held a number of research and portfolio management roles. And as maybe some of you know, as of the 1st of January this year, as part of our succession planning, Allison was named president and Caroline became our CEO. Now, as this is an investment content webinar, we're not going to be discussing that as part of our main discussion points. But if there's any questions afterwards, we can obviously talk about that a little bit. If anyone is interested in the topic, I would strongly suggest that you have a look at a webinar and a podcast that we did on the topic that was done by Rich Pzena and Bill Lipsy. The webinar with video is on our website, and the podcast vocal. Audio only is on all the regular podcast platforms. So to start things off, when we did this webinar a year ago, the conventional wisdom was that inflation was going to be transitory, the global economy was strong, and that Putin was only saber rattling on the Ukraine's borders. Now things clearly look more uncertain today. Caroline, if we can start with you, please. How do you think about things?
What a year. That's all I can say. And it's probably a good lesson in no one knows anything about the future. It turns out inflation hasn't really been transitory and interest rates have been on the rise across the world. And that really has led to multiple contractions across the board. So Lucy, if you can show the chart. Yes, thank you. So if you look at this this table, the one titled the 2022 year total returns shows the overall returns from equity markets in different regions of the world. And as one can see, you know, we experienced anywhere between 15 and 20% declines during the year. However, if you look at that first column titled peak to trough declines, stocks were actually down 25 to 35% at the lowest point in the third quarter before rallying in Q4. And this is primarily driven by multiple contractions other than in emerging markets. So you know, we sort of broke down that returns into fundamental returns, i.e. dividend and earnings growth and the multiple contractions. What's interesting to note is really the rising interest rate environment has had a fairly significant impact on multiple, and rightfully so. And it's led to a starting point of multiple that's much more attractive than where we were at the beginning of 2022. Now, as value investors, We actually see uncertainty as a feature of the market that creates valuation opportunities for us, whether it happens for microeconomic reasons at the company or macroeconomic reasons. The asymmetry in risk reward that's created in response to uncertainty is what we actually seek to take advantage of. So from our standpoint, an uncertain environment is not necessarily different versus what we have always worked with going back in history. And the starting point of valuation today, having already discounted a significant degree of pain, as shown in this chart, is an interesting starting point.
Okay, thanks for that. Alison, question for you. Are we going to a recession?
Great question. I wish I had the answer. I don't think anyone really does. You know, are we in a recession already? I mean, that's another question for you. As Caroline showed, the stocks have discounted that this is definitely happening. And I think what's important to keep in mind is we get very afraid of these moments about what's happening with the economic cycle and what's happening in terms of recessions. But, you know, Lucy, do you have that GDP chart? I think it's interesting to keep in mind that, you know, global recessions are interruptions in growth, but for the most part, very brief, and we move on. You know, this is a pretty smooth line here in terms of the world GDP history. Now, that's not to say that there aren't winners and losers, right? There are certainly companies that in hard times will suffer permanent impairment, but there are also many that won't. And today we're finding lots of businesses across the world that are priced as though they're going to have this extreme pain. And through the valuation being that cheap, if you can then look at each company and figure out, you know, who are the companies that can see through, even if there is a painful period, you know, one of these divots that you see on the chart, then it's a very, very compelling opportunity to be able to buy some really great businesses on sale.
Okay, so Carolyn, if you go to a recession globally, how do that affect stocks?
So recessions are certainly bad for earnings, more so in some sectors versus others. But going back to what we looked at earlier, you know, stocks were down 25 to 35% from peak to trough last year. And that's about in line with what we usually observe during sort of in the lead up to recessionary periods for equity market. Can it get worse? Perhaps. But the market is generally forward looking. And a lot of the negatives are already discounted at the moment. So if you take a company we have in the portfolio, PVH, so the brand owner of Tommy Hilfiger and Calvin Klein, they have strong brands with wide space to expand into long term. And the company has shown the ability to really translate that brand power online. So kind of well set up for the structural changes in the retail business. It's trading at around 6 times our long term normalized earnings estimate on current earnings, which reflects a significant degree of pain through cost inflation, kind of disruptions to the operations and still sort of macroeconomic pain at the consumer level. It's trading at about 10 times, has a healthy balance sheet, good operating flexibility. So we think it can get through whatever difficult time that's to come. So overall, you know, not a whole lot has to go right for the stock to work. And in our view, as the market is valuing it as if today's difficult conditions will last forever, that's a pretty interesting opportunity. And one thing I want to highlight is when stocks trough, it tends to be a really good time for value stocks. So examining past episodes of kind of declining markets and recessionary periods, you know, what we observe is value stocks outperform by about 70%, 70 on average over the following 5 years in the global context and about 40% in the US context. And it's important to point out that stocks generally do not trough at the bottom of the economic cycle because of the forward-looking nature of market. Already, we have seen a meaningful change in the market's assessment of recession risk. Whether that's right or wrong, we don't really know. But all we know is what we can pay, that, you know, we can pay to buy good businesses at the moment, and a lot of them not only will make it to the other end, even if conditions deteriorate, but they will probably come out of the other end with a stronger business, and you're paying a very cheap valuation on both relative and absolute basis at the moment.
Thanks. Alison, coming back to you. Last year was a good year for value. Does that give you less confidence in the next year and the next 5-year performance that Caroline described?
Well, it was a good year relatively for value, right? I mean, the relative performance of value versus growth was, I think, the best it's been in over 20 years. But value stocks were still down. So, you know, it's still not fun to get on a call and have to tell someone that you lost their money. But when you look at sort of what tends to happen historically, there is this view that value stocks generally should underperform going into a recession, and then, as Caroline described, outperform coming out of it. But when you look at cycles historically, that's not always what you see. They sometimes do outperform also going into the recession, and then, you know, you still see that outperformance on the other side of it. And the reason is it depends on the starting point of valuation and where valuation spreads are. So I think it's always helpful to keep that in mind. And we have a chart on this. Lucy, if you can pull up that price to book. Yeah, so this is a very busy page. I apologize for that. Some people on the call will be familiar with this because we show it a lot. But what we're looking at here, this is using price to book. So as you would know, for us as value investors, we're focused on normalized earnings power. But for the purposes of getting data that goes back, you know, 50 plus years, price to book is a pretty reliable metric to look at. So within each of the regions globally, we're looking at valuation dispersion on price to book. So what's the difference between the cheapest 20% and the most expensive 20% within each market on price to book? And what does that spread look like versus the historic average? So if we're at an average valuation moment, the spread should be at that zero standard deviation line in each of these charts. And as you can see, we are well above that. So spreads are still very wide. You know, that peak that you see is the COVID, you know, the first part of 2020, and then the coming down is the positive part of the value cycle that we've been experiencing over the last couple of years. But despite that happening, we're still in a very widespread environment. As you can see, you know, in the US, for example, spreads have only been wider than this 8% of the time going back to 1964. So it's still a very attractive moment for value investing, which makes it very clear that on the other side of this, you know, there's a lot of room for value stocks to still outperform. Now, so far in this cycle, what's happened is a lot of what's cheap is the same types of businesses that were cheap 2 years ago because the fears are so cyclical in nature. So despite value outperforming, there hasn't been a very clear rotation on an industry level of what's cheap. We have seen certainly some names outperform, and we've been scaling back or exiting them over the last year. A lot of names in the energy sector, for example, within energy services, Halliburton, Technip, FMC, Exxon, in the US, and also energy related names like the Czech utility ČEZ, which has benefited from the high energy cost environment. And at the same time, you know, a lot of very high quality businesses with great balance sheets have just gotten cheaper and cheaper on these cyclical fears. So we've been adding names like the European hotel chain Accor, Alibaba in China, which I you know, is a pretty interesting one. Randstad, the global staffing agency. So it's been a great time to be adding some really interesting names that have gotten cheap because of the fear and with this huge valuation dispersion.
Okay. So the post-recessionary environments are usually pretty good for stocks on average, but all signs point to a recession this year and inflation that is its highest in decades, basically. Caroline, that doesn't sound like a good backdrop for stocks, does it really?
It certainly sounds challenging, but you know, it's hard to make macroeconomic predictions, as we already spoke about at the beginning of this conversation. We think it's even harder to predict market reactions to macroeconomic conditions. However, there are episodes in history that one can examine, and we do think kind of what took place in the 1973 to 82 period bears some resemblance to what's going on today. So if you look going back to sort of that decade in the 70s, we had regional conflict in the Middle East, similar to what's going on in Ukraine today. We had very high oil prices because of the OPEC embargo, and that really fed into inflation, which averaged around over 8% every year during that decade. And we had two global recessions in that 10-year period. So not a particularly rosy backdrop for the economy or equity market. However, if you look at global GDP at the end of the day, you know, as Allison discussed earlier, it did grow by over 3% every year throughout that decade. And equities returned over 5% every year, with value in particular outperforming by close to 700 basis points per annum, generating a very nice return after inflation. However, bonds and expensive stocks did not necessarily keep up with inflation during that period. So it's not to say history has to repeat itself, but I think it's kind of an interesting period to look at and see kind of what happened in the different asset classes that bear some resemblance to the current period. Now, one of the things, as Allison discussed earlier, is, you know, we are a strong believer that expected return is always a function of the starting point of long-term expected return is always a function of the starting point of valuation and the and sustainable earnings power of a business. One of the questions we get quite a bit from people is what's going on with earnings? Surely cyclical companies are under more earnings pressure as we look at a more difficult macroeconomic backdrop. And I think it's fair to say cyclical businesses are likely to see more earnings decline in the early stages of a recession. But a lot of that pressure has already been reflected in the earnings estimate for 2023. So it's not like the market isn't anticipating that. And that's been accompanied by share price declines in some of these businesses. However, this is where the stock picking gets interesting. The company specific development that may benefit long-term outcome for the business isn't necessarily reflected. So one of our holdings in the portfolio is Rexel, a global electrical equipment distributor that's based in France. It's actually benefited so far from the inflationary environment because it has been able to pass through the price increase that it's seeing from suppliers, and it's benefiting from the write-up in their inventory. Most importantly, the specific self-help that we have been kind of betting on at Rexel is really playing out in this difficult environment, and that's translated into accelerating share gains as well as margin improvement. And the longer term, the company is obviously exposed to the sort of overall electrification, decarbonization trend that we're seeing around the world. So the stock's done actually relatively well, but it remains one of our core holdings because remarkably, you know, its multiple has compressed over the past year, despite improving sales and margins because of concerns around the near-term uncertainty from a macro perspective. So that's kind of what we're seeing, and that's what's interesting and exciting for us.
Allison, coming to you again. Do you see a backdrop similar to the last stagflation period?
Well, I hate to say it again, but I don't know. I mean, who really does know? But from our perspective, it's really about finding companies where the valuation is good and the business is good and not trying to be market forecasters, you know, companies like Rexel that Caroline was talking about. And I can tell you, you know, across the board, value stocks are one of the few asset classes where you actually have a real earnings yield at the moment. In fact, we have this. Oh, thank you. Thanks, Lucy. So you can see here that the current real earnings yields here on the right side of this chart, looking at cheap stocks, expensive stocks, and bonds. And the only positive number is the cheap stocks, you know, nearly 8% current real earnings yield. So, you know, for bonds, you need rates to go down in order to get a positive real earnings yield. For expensive stocks, you need the multiples to expand. Again, I'm not sure, you know, if that's likely in the near term. But what you can see is, because of the valuation of cheap stocks, you're getting a lot of a return just sitting still. You know, a stock we recently added to the portfolio is ArcelorMittal, the world's largest steel producer. So, you know, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of fear around a cyclical name like a steel company at this moment. But what we do know is last quarter, they had a over 30% free cash flow yield. Management plans to unwind a bunch of working capital over the next year and return most of that cash to shareholders. So the pain may be coming. You know, we don't want to be naive about that. But in the meantime, you know, we're happy to sit here and collect all that cash at such a low multiple.
Caroline, coming to China, how do you think it would emerge now that it's dropped its zero COVID policy?
Well, you know, one kind of, as a value person who really always traffics in uncertainty, you hate to use the word for sure, but it's pretty hard to see how the end of COVID, zero COVID policy doesn't lead to positive development for the Chinese economy. There may be lots of other issues that China has to wrestle with, but the unleashing of economic activities post-COVID is a positive for both the Chinese and, we think, global economies. Just, you know, bringing back to stocks, because we're really, really not trying to make investment based on macroeconomic forecast. And we think kind of picking stocks that have specific developments that we can really sort of zero in on and figure out is the way to move forward. Our holding in Galaxy Entertainment, a gaming company based in Macau, is one name that really should benefit from the reopening of China and the pent-up travel demand that comes with it. Now, that's obvious to everyone, right? What I think is less obvious, and it's really interesting to us, is the fact that Galaxy, having really improved the quality of its offering versus competitors during COVID, really taking advantage of the strong balance sheet to reinvest when peers were all burdened by very high debt levels, is something that uniquely positions them to generate significant earnings improvement as we exit the zero COVID environment. One of the things that I think is sort of interesting to point out is it's not like the market doesn't recognize the improved prospect in China. And this is why we have seen dramatic rally in Chinese stocks since the end of October. It's probably a good lesson in kind of what uncertainty and volatility can look like, and letting valuation be our guide or compass for navigating in this environment, we think is a pretty good way of moving forward. And that's really what has led us to be able to deploy capital into the Chinese market when things looked very uncertain. But, you know, we had a view on where the long-term earnings power of these businesses may lead to and how cheap the valuation was as a starting point.
Okay. We're doing good for time, but there are lots of questions from the audience, and I want to get to a few of them. So we'll do that in a second. I'm going to just kind of wrap things up here. But before I do that, can you both, it's like a show and tell effectively, talk about one of your favorite names each in our portfolio holdings, starting with you, Alison, please.
Oh, gosh. Wow. It's like choosing a favorite child. One name one name that comes to mind, it's a big position in our portfolios and a really high quality name is Michelin, the European tire manufacturer. So, you know, this is one of the highest quality tire manufacturers globally. It happens to sit in Europe as its domicile, but, you know, is globally exposed. I'll say that European domicile has probably caused more pain to the multiple this year just because of all the fear around Europe. But even beyond that, there is a lot of controversy in the auto space generally, both on the OEM side as well as auto parts, because of, you know, a lot of things going on in the industry. For Michelin specifically, there has been a lot of pain on raw material cost pressure, but the structure of the industry is very strong, and their position is as well. So we're confident that that's really a temporary point of pain, and those price increases will continue to be passed through to consumers, which we're already seeing. You know, the company is premium priced. There's a lot of margin opportunity because you don't see that in the margins on the cost cutting side, continuing to make strides there. And then the big controversy in the auto space around the transition to electric vehicles is actually a huge benefit for Michelin. You know, they're very strong in terms of the higher quality tires that you need in EV. And, you know, in case everyone didn't know that already, when we're all driving electric vehicles, our tires are going to be wearing out a lot more often. So it's actually good in terms of the future outlook for demand on the volume side. And all of this at a single digit price to normalized earnings because of the fear around what's happening cyclically and some of these other sort of temporary issues.
Okay. Caroline, a few words about your favorite chart, please.
Yeah. Like, as Allison said, it's always a tough one. I'm going to pick one that everybody might be sort of, everyone I'm sure is familiar with, Wells Fargo Bank in the US. So it has the number three retail deposit franchise in the US with a very long-term history of good profitability, you know, in excess of 15% return through the cycle. And in 2018, due to historical conduct issues, especially the fake account scandals that surfaced in 2016, the Federal Reserve imposed asset cap on Wells Fargo, really limiting its ability to grow for the subsequent periods. And that has really weighed on the earnings and the growth of Wells Fargo versus peers. At the same time, they have to spend significant amount of money to retool the internal processes and put better controls in place. All said, they've absorbed, I think, close to $19 billion US dollars in fines, customer remediation costs, legal reserves, and other expenses tied to kind of these historical conduct issues. So there are lots of things have kind of gone wrong at this company. Well, what do we like about it? First of all, the value of the deposit franchise is really unimpaired at Wells Fargo. 5 years into it, I think it's pretty obvious, you know, customers aren't abandoning the company because of the scandal. And we've seen their net interest income grow by about 27% last year, kind of in line with JP Morgan, which is widely viewed as best in class amongst US banks. And two, there are lots of company specific levers that they can pull to resolve the legacy conduct issues and reduce the cost and improve the earnings prospect over time. And that's really uniquely available to Wells Fargo versus other US banks. Three is just valuation. You know, it's trading at 1.3 times tangible book value multiple versus a normalized ROEs that's in the mid-teens, no different versus peers, but a valuation that's at a significant discount to peers. Now, because of the legacy conduct issues, ultimately is driven by governance, Wells Fargo has been on what we call the opportunity list at Pzena. So a list of businesses where we see material ESG related issues and opportunities for improvement. And these are the companies where, you know, we're focusing our resources in terms of engagement and dialogues with management on ESG issues. We have spoken to the company on a very regular basis in order to understand, you know, how it's shifting the culture and the governance, how it defines and compensates for success, and really voice our concerns regarding the pace and transparency of progress in resolving these regulatory matters. So that's this is one of the exciting ideas that we have in the portfolio at the moment.
Okay, right. Let's go to questions now. And there's quite a few out there, and Lucy's very kindly put them to groups to help me kind of, we won't get through them all. I'm going to try and just pick a range of them for the last 10 minutes or so. This one's a bit of a left field one. I think we're going to start with this. The question goes as follows. Why did small cap stocks underperform so much in 2022? And do you think it's a good time to allocate there? Allison, go that one, please.
Sure. So small cap stocks tend to be thought of as more domestically exposed. And so, you know, not atypically, when the fear is around what's happening in domestic economies and are we moving into a recession, small caps often do underperform. And that's what we saw this year. You know, the degree of underperformance varied a bit by region, but it was fairly consistent globally. You know, a place like Europe, where we've had, I would say, the biggest fears, we saw the most of that. So, you know, really exciting time, you know, because for us, you know, we are focused on small caps as well, with, you know, domestic as well as international and global portfolios. It's been a really great opportunity to find some fantastic businesses that are just really not understood and not well covered. You know, it's a little bit of searching under rocks in small cap land, which is very exciting. I mean, I know for me, when I first joined the team, I focused on US small cap names. And so sort of near and dear to my heart. But in my mind, small cap is actually one of the best places for investors to focus today, particularly on the value side, because we've already seen that underperformance. Again, not atypical at this point in the cycle. And what you generally see is on the other side, you know, as we move through the recession, similar to what we see value stocks doing and outperforming, you see the same thing in small cap land. So, you know, it's a little bit turbocharged to think about small cap and value together. So again, you know, 2022, that underperformance completely foots with what's been happening in the environment. And I think we should see the other thing, the other coming out the other side of positive performance as well.
Thank you. Caroline, I think this one you can take if you can, please, unless you want to give it to Alison. A big part of your message is that you think we're in a value rally. What would you say to the suggestion that the significant changes we've seen take place in the world over the last 10 years means that value as a way of investing is all over?
It's an interesting question. So let me step back to kind of how we think about value and you know, sort of why we think the opportunities exist. To us, value investing at its core is really about the human emotional response to negative development and uncertainty. And I think it's fair to say human emotional response doesn't really change over time. And if you look at our philosophy, it comes down to we're looking to buy good businesses when they are on sale. Now, who wouldn't? I think every manager stands up and says they want to buy good businesses at a low price. And our view is one of the opportunities, one of the ways to have access to good businesses at a low valuation is when something negative has emerged, either in the business or the valuation. That's obvious to everyone. But the resolution of that something that's negative is not obvious or certain. And that's really what the research is about, right? To figure out what's the range of outcomes that can materialize in that business. And most importantly, what's already being discounted in the starting point of valuation? Do we have that risk-reward asymmetry moving forward? One of the things we like to say is, you know, the future is sort of unforecastable. We don't really know what has to happen. What we do know is how the business may react to different environments. And what you know is the price that you're paying for that range of outcomes. So it's a long-winded way of answering. We don't think anything has changed. If anything, you know, if we're entering an environment with more uncertainty and more volatility, that's probably a pretty good one from a value investor's perspective.
Thank you. Here's another one. It says, you talked about China. Any other regional observations you can share? Is there anywhere specifically you think value is going to have a particularly good run? Alison?
Sure. Well, we already talked about sort of the small cap opportunity at the moment that we're seeing out there. You know, when you look globally, everywhere is cheap and everywhere valuation spreads are wide. You know, thinking of that first chart that Caroline shared at the opening of her comments, where you saw how valuations have come down everywhere. And in terms of fundamental return, the place where earnings have really cracked the most is emerging markets. To me, that makes emerging markets very interesting, because it is always nice to come in once the pain has arrived already. Now, even within emerging markets, you see a lot of dispersion, right? A lot of the pain there is about what's happened with China, and you have other pockets that have continued to perform very well. So you have to sort of pick your spots, which is why we think a fundamental approach is always the best in the emerging market space. You know, looking around the world, obviously a lot of the pain And a lot of the worry this year has been very focused on Europe, big underperformance for the first three quarters of the year. And then, of course, Europe enjoyed the rally of being the best performing region in the fourth quarter, with sort of, I would say, kind of like the worst case scenarios being taken off the table a little bit in investors' minds, but still a really good opportunity on valuation there as well.
Okay, this one's about your new roles, guys. Congratulations to both Alison and Caroline on their new roles. The question follows up with, do you really think you can continue to properly fulfill your PM commitments and take on significant responsibility and time commitment that come from running a $50 billion asset manager? Caroline?
Sure. The quick answer is yes. Because the title may be new, but we've really been taking on the business responsibilities for some time now, both Alison and I. In other words, you know, we've kind of been doing this for some time. It wasn't like we flipped a switch on Jan 1 and took on completely new responsibilities. So just a little bit background. I joined the executive committee, which is the management, sort of the day-to-day management body of the firm, back in 2019. And Alison started participating in executive committee conversations at the beginning of 2022 as well. So both of us have had a long look at what's entailed and the real process of apprenticeship to understand kind of what it means to take on some of that business responsibility. Couple of things that I think are important to highlight. One is both Alison and I'm speaking for her here, but I think we're on the same page with this, are really interested in taking on that responsibility because we believe having the firm be led by investment people is in the best long-term interest of both our clients and our team. And we want all decisions to be really examined through the lens of a disciplined value investor, not necessarily a business person's perspective, right? The second thing I just want to highlight is we also added long-term leaders of our functional areas, such as operations and finance, to the executive team over the last 3 years. And looking back, you know, think about Rich Pazina, Bill Lipsey, and John Goetz, kind of our founders, having run the firm and having investment responsibility in the case of Rich and John, they didn't always have those support for the 25 years history of being on the executive committee, but they did it, and in a public company context too. So it's not to say, you know, the job is easier today, but what Rich dealt with, but it's certainly manageable today, I think. And I'm happy to say there hasn't been any surprises since Jan 1st. So we feel pretty good about taking on these responsibilities. Alison, I don't know if you have anything to add.
Yeah, I think it's worth mentioning that we've tried to make space for them as well. Both of us have given up significant portfolio management responsibilities and stock coverage responsibilities because, you know, as you mentioned, the most important thing to us is to make sure that we maintain and continue to have investment excellence. And that's really where our focus is. So by making sure that we get rid of some of the activities that we were doing to make, I would say, more than enough space for the management responsibilities, that way we can ensure that the investment team and approach and process and our attention on it doesn't diminish in any way.
We'll do a couple more questions, I think, we've got time for. This one, I like. Investors around the world clearly had different experiences in 2022, depending on where they were sitting and how their base currency performed. I'm not talking about sterling here. The question is, how do you think about currency when you're evaluating companies, and do you ever hedge it out? And let's go with Alison for that one, please.
Sure. So we don't do any hedging for a whole bunch of reasons, but we certainly do think about currency. Right. So when you think about our analysis, you know, we're very focused on this concept of normalized earnings power. What should this company earn? And when you're looking at that, if there's anything in the history that's either been a benefit or a curse because of movements in the currency, we really try to strip that out so that we're just looking at the economic earnings power of each company. Now, you can't ignore currency either. So, you know, if this is a company that operates in a volatile currency or multiple currencies, or, you know, if there's something on the balance sheet, you know, where currency can have a big effect one way or the other, that really affects the range of outcomes around the business. So, you know, our base case is that normal earnings valuation, but we also always try to quantify a reasonable downside and a reasonable upside case. And so if you have a lot of volatility coming from currency effects on the business, that's really going to widen that range of outcomes. And what that means for us as portfolio managers is the wider the range of outcomes, the smaller the position size should be for the same valuation, because there's just that much more uncertainty that comes into what could happen for the business.
Okay. Maybe the last question, Caroline, kind of touches to the one before about value not working anymore. After the strong price increases of the last few months, some investors are asking whether the value rally is already over. What do you think?
We don't really know. I definitely would say we definitely do not know for the next quarter or year. But we have views, of course, that are based on what we observe in the marketplace. So here are some observations that I think I can offer. As Allison shared earlier, you know, the valuation spread remains very wide. Everywhere in the world, over one standard deviation and really kind of at 85th or 85 or over 90 percentile cheapness versus the long-term history. So these are still very exceptional starting point of relative valuation for deep value stocks. And then the second thing is the absolute valuation that we see in cheap stocks offering double-digit yield, again, as you know, Allison sort of discussed earlier, is very attractive, regardless of kind of the interest rate or inflation or macro environment that we're contemplating. The third one is the quality of the businesses that we're buying is good, and they can withstand significant economic uncertainty because of the strong balance sheet and the franchise operating business model that they have. And that's what we spend a lot of our time figuring out and making sure that that's something that our holdings have. Now, going back in history, if you look at all the value cycles that have materialized, and then we sort of, you know, examine that in the US with the longest history, on average, you know, the value cycles are multi-years in duration. And I think mostly because recovery from whatever is going wrong does not resolve itself very quickly. And investors shift their views. It might be in bursts, but they shift their views slowly over the full cycle. So the average cycle on the value side has been about, I think, over 60 months in duration. And we're really less than halfway into that, if you just look at when the current pro value period started towards the back end of 2020. And the average relative outperformance from deep value stocks tend to be over 100%. And we have seen less than half of that as well. So history, again, you know, history doesn't have to repeat itself, but certainly we feel pretty good about the starting point of valuation and where things are in terms of the historical context.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes left. We're going to wrap things up, but before doing so, Allison, maybe just a few closing thoughts on what we can draw from all this, please.
Yes, you know, in listening to ourselves talk, which is you know, always a little bit painful, I think what you're hearing over and over from us is we don't know what's happening next. Which may be quite disappointing if you thought that you were tuning into this webinar to hear what's going to happen next. But I think the other part of the message is that valuation is definitely very supportive at the moment, no matter what's happening next, right? We've already priced in a pretty ugly scenario, hasn't really yet arrived for most businesses. And so valuation support is there. And if you can find a set of businesses where the pain either won't arrive, or if the conditions do worsen, you're not going to suffer permanent impairment, seems like a really good time to be grabbing those companies.
Okay. I'm going to go to the Q&A. Indulge me here. Someone has not asked a question, but put a statement. which I'm going to share. Great to see a well-worked succession plan. I remember being introduced to Caroline by Rich the week she arrived, which I think is kind of quite nice. Right, so with that, we are out of time. Thank you, Alison. Thank you, Caroline, for taking the time to chat today. Thank you also to everyone at Pazina who's helped with the planning, particularly you, Lucy, you did a great job. Lastly, thank you to all of our viewers for dialing in. There's quite a few of you. If there's anything you want in follow-up, such as a recording a copy of the recording, or you've got any follow-up questions, it's info@pazina.com. Thank you again. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Pazina Perspectives. If you'd like to hear more, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. And for more insights on value investing, visit our website at www.pazina.com. That's www.pzena.com. You can also follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter.